No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now. No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now.
Developers, 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 developers.
It's, well, let me, it's...
Since the prehistoric ages and the days of ancient Greece, what down to the Middle Ages, planet Earth kept going through changes, and then the Renaissance came, and the times continue to change. Nothing stayed the same, but there were always renegades.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the Colosseum Podcast, the show where we talk to founders about their journey navigating the crazy world of startups. Today, I'm joined by Maddie Taylor, co-founder of Colosseum, a hackathon, startup competition, accelerator, and venture fund, as well as Anatoly Yakovenko, co-founder of a small project called Solana. I'm going to pass it over to Maddie since we're kicking off today's first episode to sort of set some context and understand why it's important that he wanted to launch this podcast. So, Maddie, kick it over to you.
Awesome. Yeah, well... super excited to kick this off with you guys. We've been thinking about doing a podcast for a while, and we were trying to figure out like what would be most beneficial to not just the Solana ecosystem or the crypto ecosystem, but to our sort of founder ecosystem. And so we wanted to create a podcast that was specifically about bringing in really high quality founders, talking with them about their journey, touching on topics that really pertain to the startup ecosystem forming on Solana and in crypto broadly. So we thought no better person to kick it off with than Anatoly, the godfather of Solana itself. And so, yeah, Toly, thanks so much for joining.
For sure.
Let's start at the beginning. Toly, what was the moment that you realized you wanted to be a founder or that you were going to be a founder?
I've had like a side project, I think, with software since I was like 16 or something, I would say. Like, you know, I was a nerd in high school. So I was like into like software, Linux, and like trying to figure out how to code. And we had like a physics teacher that started teaching programming, and this was like Borland C, not even C++. That we were coding in, and I like built like a little Tron game. And that was kind of my red pill moment. And I've been kind of tooling around with stuff like this for basically since then. In college, Greg Fitzgerald, who ended up being the CTO of Solana, and I and a couple other people, we were in a startup there trying to build voice over IP systems, you know, connecting phones to software to make them all managed. I don't know if you remember this thing called Vonage.
No, what
this was
it?
Or
was that the voiceover? IP?
Yep. Or Grand Central Dispatch, which became Google Voice. Hmm. So basically, like Google Voice was like the end vision of the product, but this was years before that. So just connecting like old school phone lines to computers and managing them. That was...
I remember the in between there when that technology was absolutely horrible.
Yeah. So that was like, I would say basically my entire career, I've always had like a side project. All of them have failed. So it takes a long time, I think, and a lot of persistence to keep doing it. In fact, what's weird is Steve Ackridge, who is CTO of Anza right now, one of the co-founders, him and I were building deep learning boxes, putting them in Hurricane Electric, which is a data center nearby in the Bay Area, for running TensorFlow models. This was 2017, 2016, so pre OpenAI. This is just people just figured out that these models could generate. I don't know if you remember those first images where it all looks like alien landscapes with like eyes all over the place. This is just people figured out like the deep learning stack can do some interesting stuff in transformers. So for some weird reason, I've always had a side project too, and I was always waiting. I like there's like this there's a huge leap between building a side project that you're really interested in, one that is fundable or one that has revenue. And there's a lot of people that are skilled at identifying, I can build this like weird little SaaS company that solves a problem for somebody and makes money. I didn't have those skills. I was more like, I'm going to go down the path of finding a weird technology that may become like a really big thing, but very likely to fail.
Got it. Got it. So your intention was always that these side projects weren't just for fun. You wanted to actually pursue them full time if there was some traction. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay.
But I wasn't there's like a class of founders that are really, really good at actually building businesses. I was not one of those. I was more of like, I'm a principal engineer. I can go down a very deep rabbit hole and I might get lucky to be first to figure something out. That's kind of like that was my angle.
So with that said, talking about like the co-founder stuff, like how did you, I think I personally know about like how you went about it, because like you've said it a few times, but like, how did you go about finding your co-founders? And even though your story might be different than others, like even how you found yours and how others should go about like thinking about how to find the co-founders that they want to spend the next 10 years with, or whatever that time frame might be.
So basically I had this kind of side project with Steve Akridge, and we were building this deep learning thing. We were like just having fun putting GPU boxes together and writing some code to like, it was basic. It wasn't like anything like super interesting. It was in an interesting space, but it was just like submit your model and we'll run it for you kind of thing. Very boring software, right? But you get to play around with AI and stuff. And this was 2017 and Bitcoin was kind of going through the roof and all these other proof of work technologies were going through the roof, and we were mining crypto in the background to pay for the GPUs, which is funny. And this is how I got into crypto. I was like, why? I was of course aware of crypto. I was aware of everything. And it was obvious when I kind of had this idea for Solana, this like proof of history inception, what made me quit my job before we had any product and stuff like that was that the space was getting a lot of funding. And as a founder, that's really kind of like important when there is kind of a rush, a gold rush. And my wife was actually at Columbia working at a competitor to Facebook during the social network gold rush. And they even like met Zuckerberg in those like first moments trying to figure out who's going to acquire who or whatever or get pushed out. And in from her memory, there's like 6 months window when there is kind of a new technology where a lot of companies get funded. And if you miss that window, you kind of miss that funding cycle and then everything becomes much harder. So she actually was the one that was like, either you drop this or like, because it's never going to happen. And you have a kid and you can't spend 40, like have a full-time job and spend 40 hours a week on a side project and be a father, or you go full-time. And she was already working in tech and could support us. So it was like, I gave myself 6 months to raise money. And that was like my focus period. And what's funny is when I told Dropbox, they were like, this happens all the time. If you don't get funding in 6 months, you can just come back, no questions asked, your salary and offer and everything else, which is pretty funny. But like this is the magic of being in the Bay Area, and this is harder to do in even in San Diego where I was at before, is that when there's such a high concentration of big tech companies, middle tech companies that are all constantly hiring engineers, you can take that risk. So to pick my, in that context where I had very short window to raise money, I just grabbed all the close friends that I had that I was lucky enough to have really, really good like technical fit. Like Greg is a compiler expert, Steven's a GPU expert. Like these folks are like really, really, really good technologist, and I've been friends with him since college. Basically, played underwater hockey together, like competed for like the men's team. All three of us have done Ironman together, so like, it's kind of like they were really obvious. The weird one was Raj, because I like had zero experience with real businesses or fundraising, and my buddy Eric, who ended up joining us as well, he is a very like somebody I respect a lot. Is on the CERN Higgs boson paper. He was a physicist. He's like, he was at Omada Health at the time, and Raj just left, and he was like, my buddy Raj isn't doing anything. He's really good, really smart, and he's non-technical, and you need a non-technical co-founder. So he was kind of the person I reached out to talk to him, and Raj famously said, okay, I'll help you raise. It'll like take less than 6 months, and then we'll kind of see what happens.
Yeah. So this is actually a very similar situation that a lot of the teams in our accelerator are in. So they come out of the hackathon. It's usually a couple of devs, technical team, and they're like, oh shit. Like we just hit on a really great idea. We want to commit to this. It's becoming less of a side project and more of an actual startup. How do we find like a non-technical, you know, more business focused, co-founder? And so, you know, how did you test Raj, I guess? Like, how did you test that relationship? You didn't. Okay.
I basically had 6 months. So it was like, I didn't have time to like really test him. It was just through the fact that somebody that I deeply respected, that's extremely intelligent, recommended him and respected him.
That's what I was about to say. Like, it was like you trusted one of your co-founders, yeah, like that. So like, outside of trusting a co-founder to bring in somebody else, like, how important do you, because everybody's out there trying to find co-founders, and like a lot of the teams, like a lot of these, especially in the Solana ecosystem, like a lot of these guys, they weren't like friends growing up, but they became friends through Solana, and they were like, we have a lot in common. How important is that aspect? You know, like compatibility, like a relationship, like for co-founders, like you're going to be together a lot, you better get along type of thing.
Yeah. Like it can work out and it can fail. Like, I think like in the first 2 years, so like Greg and Steven and I, we played underwater hockey to like a world-class level, which means you're training, you're pushing yourself. We did Ironmans together. You do like exercises where you feel like drowning basically, because you're trying to like improve yourself. And it's kind of like, I know that I could push them really, really, really hard. Like, that was like kind of, and I was the CEO of Labs, still am. The reason why I felt confident in like bringing those two guys on, just even though like outside of the technical stuff, was that like you have to kind of like founder mode or whatever people talk about, it's that those 2 years you're like squeezing every possible thing out of your coworkers and your friends. And it's stressful and it's hard and relationships strain and people burn out and you have to push them past the burnout. You're like, this is the hard part, is that like, it's not nice. You have to pick the kind of friends that you don't have to be nice to. And they understand that they're not being nice to you for a very important reason. Is that they can still remain friends. And this is like, we're still friends. Like, I think Greg basically burned out on year three and had to like kind of take a break, and he is like a world-class athlete. He's done like Xterra, you know, like the championship in Hawaii and stuff. This is somebody that can push himself extremely hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it very similar? Like you said, you're doing Ironman. So yeah. So like, you got people that can actually push through that burn to make it to the end. Like, that's like an important fact, but you don't always know that until you knew these guys very deeply that they could do that. Yeah. So like, not everybody's in that position as young founders.
Yeah, this is, I think, the difference. I think the advantage that I had over a lot of, I'd say, competitors and other teams was that I had almost 20 years experience at that point as just an engineer going down like the principal engineer track. Once I knew I had a design, I knew we could build it. I knew I could hire for the pieces that needed to be built and evaluate and all that stuff. And the people that I brought on, I was just lucky that I knew I could push them.
Yeah.
Like that, that's, yeah. It's tough to do that. You can, I think it's really, really hard to do that with employees. You can push co-founders to the point of breaking. Yeah. And if, and I'm lucky that we're still friends. I mean, you know, like.
Yeah. Awesome. Speaking of breaking, I heard Solana in the early days almost went broke from, you know, burn rate was becoming an issue. And so I think it's maybe a good segue to talk about like fundraising. Like how did you guys go about fundraising in the early days? How many rounds did you guys raise? And like, how should people think about this?
So first of all, I want to kind of like, the worst thing is to raise for the wrong company. And like, because then you're wasting your time and investors' time, right? And like, you feel like you missed this huge opportunity. And the more you raise, the worse it is, because it's just going to take longer or you burn through the money faster and in an ineffective way. The best founders are the ones that are able to recognize that they didn't get PMF and their thesis is just totally wrong. And halfway, they give all the funds back to the investors and just like, hey, this isn't going to work. Like, we're just going to walk away. And those guys will get funded again, like guaranteed. Like if that founder comes back to me like 6 months later or 18 months later and says I have a different idea, it's another company, it's just almost like a sure thing to bet on him again. So like the worst thing is to just like work on the wrong idea. So then the challenge is like you need to raise as much money as you can. You need to evaluate the idea with the least amount of resources and as fast as possible. And sometimes you can do that. Sometimes the ideas are too big. Like building something like Solana is just too big of a task to be able to evaluate PMF. But there in those markets, why those companies still get funded, even though you know in 18 months you might not know whether this particular thing will succeed or not, is that you have a lot of competitors that are kind of hitting PMF or some amount of traction that's meaningful to investors. So then you're competing, you're basically using that market and how fast that market is growing as the proof for PMF. And then that's almost a little easier to evaluate. So the weird thing is that like we were blessed to have never raised like a massive amount of funding in the early days. So I was always like resource constrained. That meant like I had to be really, really good at bringing in the kind of people that I can push and can output a lot of code and do very high quality work. And then we had to limit the feature set to just like the smallest bare bones thing that I thought could win. So I think this is kind of like, if you raise it, I would almost think that any company that raises like $100 million is much less likely to succeed than one that raises like 5 to 10.
Your first raise was like less than a 2021 shit tier NFT project though for Solana.
Yeah, we raised $3 million as our seed stage. Then in the summer we did like an A round that was like 15, and that was we had to get a couple bridges, and we always kind of had 30, like, you know, once you raise, you kind of hit 36 months of runway, then you hire a bunch of people and you get down to like below 24 and then it starts counting down. And when you hit like 12 months, it starts being uncomfortable because either you have to get runway, right? Like within that 1 year. So by 2020, we were at like, I think less than 12 months, and I severely trimmed down the team to the bone, like just to get us a few more months and to get to launch.
One, I mean, there's a lot going on in that. Like you're building this product, you're trying to get to the mainnet launch, but you're also thinking about burn. what is your recommendation to founders? Should you just focus on fundraising when you're fundraising and then focus on product when you can, or do you mix the two, or how do you think about compartmentalizing that?
It's too hard. Like fundraising is like the CEO, like has to be like done full time by the CEO and like maybe like the COO, like the business part, the non-technical part. And the way to do it is you really need to craft your story and your pitch, and then have like pack all your meetings in 1 week, do all the fundraising in parallel, and like either it works or it doesn't, right? Like you're kind of like making a bet and you get as much money as you can, and then you stop and then you go build a product. So it's like, I want founders to realize that it's like okay to fail. Like this is like, you shouldn't count on it, and you got to work as hard as you can. But the worst outcome is just continue working on the worst, on the wrong thing. And if one of the ways that you fail is that like mid stage of the company, you fail to get more money because stuff isn't working, you didn't hit enough traction or PMF compared to whatever, like it's okay. Like you can walk away at that point. But you should really, really kind of just time box it. Otherwise, like it's exhausting. It takes a lot of work, and you want to do the best job possible. So you do a lot of practice pitches. Like I think the seed stage one, I probably took 1,000 meetings. Like the first one, it took like 6 months of me like reaching out and talking to people. And I would say that was like the hardest one, because you're really trying to get above that first initial kind of, like what you're really trying to secure is like a reasonable lead. It doesn't have to be the top tier S tier fund, but like a pretty good fund that's the anchor fund that people respect. That what respect means is that in the later stage of the company, that fund will follow on and write a check and support their thesis through the time that it takes to actually credibly figure out whether this thing is going to work or not. That's what a good fund is. That's just the only thing that you differentiates a good fund from a bad fund, is that like they will back their companies at a later date. And like they have a long view and a 10-year vision. So that's really the key differentiator. And what people are looking for is that, do you have a lead that fits within that? In crypto, people tend to be really kind of fast and loose with rounds, and it's a party round. And sometimes you may raise like a seed stage round and you don't have a lead. And in the next stage, you don't have anyone that's going to back you. And a lot of stuff falls apart there. So to kind of summarize those thoughts, one is time box it as much as you can. The first raise is the most important one. It's the hardest one. You're going to take 1,000 meetings. You're going to practice your pitch like just over and over with everyone that will even talk to you, angels, whoever. At the end of the conversation, you want to ask him for a follow-up. Ask him if they will like write you an angel check, even if that fund is not going to invest. Would you like write an angel check if we secure a lead? Like, and a lot of times what we found is that really, really good funds couldn't invest in crypto, but the LPs were like, this is cool. If you guys get a lead, I'll like put in like 25K. And being able to say that in my next meetings was giving me more credibility that I convinced like whoever, right, to put in like a small check. Because
that's really good advice. Right? So that's like some really good advice.
And I like kind of, we like basically kind of strung together like 500K in angel checks before we had like our first true lead offer. So like you kind of just kind of have to do that work. And that's 20 different people that I was able to convince to say conditionally on me finding a really good investor that would give me money.
Yeah, I don't think newer founders probably know like how like hard and time consuming, especially engineering founders who just want to write code and then they like you did, and you have to step into that. But in the same like vein of like founding and raising, like the sort of polarizing topic of like low float, high FDV, the high FDV sort of token issues. What's your take on that? And like, what would be the, like, from the perspective of a founder?
So why do people do this? Is because they're afraid of the tokens being dumped in the market and the price going down. But what you're doing is you're just moving that time into the future, right? And if everyone expects it to happen into the future, you're just creating a whole lot of negative pressure psychologically and in every possible way. So functionally, like, the problem with them is that when you have these like low FTV long unlocks, it becomes advantageous for somebody that is even super bullish in the project to sell their tokens as soon as they get them and then buy locked up tokens in the future at a discount. So for the same amount of dollars, I'm increasing my percentage of this company because I know there's a whole bunch of lockups and future investors and whatever. And there's really not much you can do to prevent that because people will write side deals. Like, as soon as they unlock, you transfer to me and stuff like that. And even though that involves trust and stuff, for the vast majority of the world, trust in finance actually works fine. Yeah. It doesn't work when you have anonymous people and stuff like that. But like for funds and things like that, that definitely works. And there's nothing really you can do because you may not even have any knowledge of these deals. So you end up with like just, it reminds me of like contagion, like futures, like backwardation and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. If you're like a finance nerd and that means anything to you. But basically it feels like what you want is for that all the unlocks to be a year behind you, right? That's the ideal scenario, is that all that stuff already happened and you're now in the future. So just accelerate that.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Yeah.
And this is basically what happened with Solana itself, yeah. Right? I think from my perspective, like, yeah, seeing the stark difference between a lot of these, yeah, very high FTV launches versus what happened with Solana, where the tokens unlocked and there was honestly just such a groundswell of community members that were supportive of that very early stage, and you want to rip off the band-aid and get that community support as early as possible rather than later.
Yep, exactly. And when you look at like very long-lived projects, they've all kind of like did the original ICO where just everything gets launched all on day one.
Yeah,
and people think that's crazy or whatever. You have to like somehow protect and like manage all this stuff. It's the best way to do it. If the project has legs, it'll work out. Like, the key part is that you need to have, you know, execution on the product and really good product and growth. If you have that, the token stuff doesn't matter. And all these delays only hurt good projects. Like, they don't actually help them. So if you're a founder that believes this and you have investor pushback, I'm happy to talk to them.
Great. I think that last part is really key, though, is that like the product has to be working. The product development has to be working. And so like that can be really complicated for founders to figure out if they have product market fit or not. So would love to hear just your thoughts on how to think about product market fit, how to identify when you have it.
So I was blessed that I was not that great at fundraising. I was just barely good enough. And we always had that like pressure and, you know, 36, then 24 months of runway, and then less than 12. So I had to kind of build a thing that I thought would survive. I wasn't even trying to build something that was going to take over the world. So I was like, what can I build that is just like has a chance of surviving? And that meant I was trying to find a niche that I would be very, very hyper-focused on. So we didn't have EVM support. We had command line wallet only. It was just the most bare bones blockchain you could build that was really as fast as we could make it in the short amount of time. So we took out all the extra features that, you know, our competitors worked on, like adding EVM support and fancy explorers and like building your own wallet. And instead we just hyper focused on that one thing. And like, I think that meant that we had like a very simple story to tell, and one that was easy to demonstrate. So we built like the Break app. I don't know if you remember this thing.
Yeah.
This is Justin Starry's like monumental contribution to Solana that he curses, I'm sure, still to this day. That was like so high impact. He's just smashed the keyboard and every keystroke generates like a little transaction in a box. And I would literally use that as my sales demo or whatever. Like, hey, are you a developer? Do you want to build on a network? Look, these are all individual transactions. And that would like blow people's mind. So there was like a very specific niche that we could build. And we started getting traction that was unique and different in this very competitive landscape. And we were also lucky that we were early. So this huge market event happened, like the March 16th, like S&P 500 dropped 60% and Bitcoin dropped to like $3,000. And we announced our auction like 3 days before, and it was scheduled, you know, after we got blessed. It was scheduled just after that event. And for whatever reason, a lot of our competitors froze up or decided to delay. And I was too exhausted with only 9 months of run. I was like, fuck it. The worst time to launch is right before this crash. So right after, you can never time the market, but right after feels like if you could ever time the market, launching right after the crash is the best way to do it. So that was kind of just being early enough with a niche that was unique and could attract developers was enough of PMF for us to kind of get that initial boost.
I think there was, yeah, it was challenging to build. So it's crazy that we were able to gain critical mass of devs in the first couple of years. But like, I think like a lot of this revolves around timing, but like there was I spoke to a lot of EVM engineers that had came to Solana, and they said they were just waiting for somebody to build a fast chain that they could build high performance financial products on. So like, to me, like that was kind of the PMF. Like it was like, the products that exist, but really fast.
Yeah. So like, I think Raj says this basically, like you can think of a startup as like an impressionist painting. And there's usually one spot that is hyper focused and like almost photorealistic and crystal clear. And the rest is just slop, right? It's just like gives you an illusion of everything else. And it's that one spot that tricks your brain into thinking that everything else is just perfect. But that's kind of the lucky or the skill or whatever, and you know, a mix of both, is that can you find that spot in your product that really just excites people? And people also like kind of make the analogy that it's black licorice. Most people hate black licorice, but there's a few people that love it. So you have to build a product that some small percentage of people love. And you can get lucky where that TAM of that thing grows and becomes the most dominant thing. And those are the best investments and kind of the highest ROI things. But if you build for the average dev and the average consumer, you may build a very good, credible business that's revenue generating, but it's just not going to be that kind of like head turning product. And typically in a startup, you have to kind of take that one shot on goal and finding that one niche that's really, really good.
And then getting those like first initial super fans that flip to advocates, and then that grows into like a massive community from there.
So because we didn't have EVM support, you couldn't copy and paste EVM code and run it on Solana. That meant that people that recognized the black licorice and loved it had to put in the work to build stuff, but that also meant that they had a moat around their work. Software, you never really have more than a 6 months moat, but because nothing was copy and pasted, they actually had like a little bit of a head start from any other potential competitor. And that hurdle was a proof point that they're actually a pretty good dev that could reverse engineer really, really terrible docs and like figure out how to like glue this stuff together and build a product. That was a really, really great filter in those early days for those initial developers.
Yeah, I think like that was insanely important to get those like GigaBrain engineers on board that solved those problems that inspired the next wave, and it just the flywheel just kept going from there.
the irony is that, like, this is exactly Ethereum's story. Like, early EVM was horrible to program for. Like, the wallet support was, like, as bad as Solid. 2018 MetaMask wallet EVM support was, like, as bad as Solid.
I still love Solid. I would use it if somebody recreated it. I don't know why. I loved having 5,000 tabs behind my browser window that I didn't know what they were for. So we got a speed round of some fun questions Maddie's going to ask you, maybe some spicy ones. But, like, the last question that I wanted to ask you is sort of like, you can pick one or you can pick many. Like, you've been building Solana for 5+ years. I don't know exactly how many years it is now, but, like, what's, like, the toughest challenge, like, maybe outside of the stuff you've faced versus, you know, we've talked about funding and raising and lots of these decisions. Is there any, like, random things that stick out to you that you were, like, look back and be like, holy shit, I can't believe we made it through that, like, and, like, as, like, a founder?
No big challenges.
Is it just keeping the vibes up?
Yeah, nothing ever happened. It was pretty boring.
Especially in 2022. Yeah. Nothing happened in 2022. Yeah. But yeah, I just feel like it feels like now it's like the, especially for L1s or for, like, founders, it's like keeping the morale up becomes, like, one of the biggest challenges for everybody. Like, yeah, they talk about vibes and it becomes a meme, but, like, me being terminally online, like, it's important.
The FTX collapse was, like, gut-wrenching and terrifying. Like, that was pretty bad. It was like a car accident or like a sudden breakup, you know? Like,
yeah.
You're like, like, you walk in on your girl with whatever, right? You're like, holy shit, that just happened. It's terrible.
How did you deal with that, though? Like, how did you, as, like, somebody who's like, I might have just lost everything I've created, like, what was the rebuilding phase mentally like for you to, like,
this is where, like, co-founders that have different personalities help. So Raj is very good at crisis mode, and he, like, projects, like, an air of confidence and, like, takes action, and that's important. So you kind of, like, okay, the most important thing is, like, all the founders on the network. So we just started calling all the founders and talking to them. And the key part that we were afraid of was that everyone's funds were in FTX and that they all lost their runway, because that would have been devastating, right? Like, I think if the ecosystem kept building, like, great products, it would survive. Right. And you're not really, like, this is probably right advice, but the best, like, your mindset when you're trying to, like, win shouldn't be to, like, I need to win. It's, you should just be trying to survive like a wounded animal. Right. If you can keep that mindset that your goal is just survival, right? You're in the dark forest and you're a wounded animal. That's, I think, those are the companies that win. And I think by, you know, luck or unluck, right, we were always kind of that wounded animal. And the most important thing for us was that, like, making sure that the companies that were building products had runway. And, like, some really, really good teams got hit really hard, like Backpack lost. They just did a raise, Series A. It was, like, their leg up raise. And all those funds were, like, locked up. And it turned out to be a forcing function for them. Like, I think that energy that they put into those 6 months turned the whole ecosystem around. Like, this,
and
is
they're good. Still, and they're still out there crushing it right now. Yeah. And, like, now they, like, so, like, that's another really great story.
So that was really, really challenging. I would say, in terms of, like, all the headwinds that Solana's faced, that was probably the worst one.
Yeah. Well, just to finish off this episode, we wanted to, intro kind of a new section where we talk about if something's overrated or underrated. So we're going to give you a word or a phrase and you say overrated or underrated, and you can give some justification too. But let's start out with founder mode.
Underrated, I would say. Was actually, like, I think the key insight that I weirdly had, again, because first-time founder. I was very, very nervous. But I think, like, you have to drive people towards a goal that will get you to survive. This is how you got to think. Like, I have 18 months of runway. I need to know that we're going to survive by month 12, right? So, because 6 months left, you have to raise or you have to have revenue or something. So as a founder, if you can put yourself into that survival mode, like a wounded animal, that's founder mode. Is you're making sure everyone is just set on a single goal. No one is doing anything inefficient and you're just driving towards that thing. I think it's underrated and it's really, really important. This is, I think, the biggest advantage to decentralized kind of ecosystems versus a big company. You could have a single big company that builds all the same products as Solana does, but you're not going to have 100 different founders that are in founder mode that are pushing these products as hard as they can. And you just can't, like, one, only the founder can be in founder mode, only like the CEO, because they're the ones that are going to raise or show investors or get revenue, or, you know, they're the first salesperson. So that person has to be the one that is deciding which risks the company has to take. And everyone else's job is to de-risk it and make sure it gets done. So I would say it's underrated.
Got it. Chase, I think we need to rename this podcast immediately to Animal Survival Mode. is basically going to be the theme of this podcast going forward. All right, next one, network extensions.
I think it's good for Solana to pick different marketing names for technologies, because it's otherwise there's no, like, people get confused, and we saw that with just restaking. As soon as Jito announced a product that looked something like restaking, there was just like, we want to be the eigenlayer of Solana. Like, five different people were pitching this to me. And I was like, why? Like, what purpose does it serve? How does it actually do this? So I think technologies that use some parts of L2s, but not all, but like the main principle is get as much stuff working on mainnet on the L1 and then connect provable things to it. That's very different than go build an OP and ARP and whatever super chains on top of Solana and use Solana as a DA layer. And you have to guide the community with narrative, and picking a different narrative is part of that, right? Is like, marketing is narrative. You're like, we're not doing L2s. We're not doing super chains on top of Solana or whatever.
We don't need to be a beholden to the Ethereum gods. Like, we can call shit whatever we want.
And when people are like arguing whether these are L2s or not, it's just great, because it's just,
we made all this stuff. We made all this
noise cycle, right?
We made this whole thing up anyways. Yeah. So what's it matter? Yeah.
So yeah. Underrated.
Yeah. Okay. Next one, relocating offshore as a founder.
Overrated, I would say. There's not. It doesn't matter. The key parts here is, like, if you build a business, you're going to have to comply with U.S. laws and regulations and figure out how to deal with them no matter what, either by blocking U.S. customers and stuff like that. So whether you do that in the U.S. or outside of the U.S., doesn't really matter, right? Like, unless you're, like, inside China building for the Chinese market, which is firewalled away from the rest of the world, like, you're basically kind of in the world that's going to interact with the US, so you're gonna have to figure out how to deal with it.
As a resident, I told Maddie before we did this, I was like, as a resident, like, SF Maxi being you, I was like, I already know this is gonna be an overrated answer from Anatoly.
I would say, like, to pick a spot in the US, it is really between SF and New York. And I'm still bullish on SF simply because all the kind of big funds are here, and you have Stanford and Berkeley, which just constantly produce new talent. And you have a bunch of founders, like, that are over 40 that are still hanging out here, because past 40, you're just not going to move to Austin. You're like too you're too old. You don't really care. So you're still like, it's still going to be very, very hard for another city to gain momentum.
It'll take a while. It might be 10 years before you're even there and your business is already dead or alive at that point.
So Chase is going to need to sell his house in Costa Rica and move back up to the Tenderloin.
Costa Rica is the same time zone as SF. We're very close. So it's like, if you can find a spot in the same time zone as San Francisco that has really good surf, that's a very good hack.
FYI, there's no tax laws here. It's just I work too much and I want to be next to a wave that I can leave this call right after this, go surf for 30 minutes and come back for my next meeting.
Oh, that's actually a good one. I'm going to add in a new one here. That's a good segue from that one. Work-life balance as a founder.
This is a big spicy debate online. Some people think they should work 24 hours a day. And some people I've seen a lot about it lately.
You have to be very effective about your time. It actually there were moments where it was very, very hard for me to be a father, like weeks at a time, but it wasn't all the time. And I think people, there's like good chunks where you don't have any work-life balance. But I think the harder part isn't having a family. It's like, I would say dating would be impossible while being a founder, because that just wastes so much time. It's such a time wasting activity, and it's supposed to be that
unless she can be your co-founder.
Yeah, it's just not conducive for being in that moment. But like when you have a family, you're kind of like, I need to hyper-focus on my kid for 2 hours and make it as high quality of a time as I can. They're going to go to bed. I'm going to go code, right? Like, so if you can be hyper-focused, family is maybe even better than being single, because you have that emotional support, and the practice of being focused with a kid is what you need when you're working, is that you have to be efficient about how you use your time. And if you can improve your focus, it's probably better than improving the hours that you're spending on it.
Yeah.
That's good advice.
Have you guys seen the chart of least attractive interests? Yeah. So I think crypto people are screwed anyways, because it's like the least attractive thing ever. This last one we're going to end on, Ethereum.
It's great. I mean,
overrated or underrated?
No,
first.
Overrated, underrated, totally.
Underrated.
I had a feeling that was coming. Yeah. So yeah, but yeah, go ahead and like give your. I know you're like, you love Ethereum, so like, let's hear a little bit about why.
really, really good research. I think the technology stack that they picked and kind of the direction is Pareto efficient. It is a massive ship to steer. And the fact the merge went off without a hitch, and kind of they're doing all the right things that I would be, if I was a leader in the Ethereum community, I probably wouldn't pick too many different options, because you have to balance all the interests of all the existing applications and all this other stuff. And even as much as I criticize the idea of trying to build something that's money, I think it's fine to try to do it, because it is so disruptive and such a huge high impact thing. That doesn't mean that everyone has to go build a money thing. It can go build, like, if Bitcoin's already building store of value, even if I think it's awesome, I don't need to go build store of value. I can hyper focus on like this one niche that I think makes a very beautiful impressionist painting, right? Like, can you find that like really, really unique product and hyper focus on it? I think it's part of this. But I think if Ethereum pulls it off and builds this very like easy to verify substrate for all of these different technologies to go through with better than honest majority assumptions, I think it's a very, very cool thing. And I don't see a reason why, and I make this joke, but it is serious. There's no reason why Solana data couldn't be put into the Ethereum blocks with proofs for state roots to enable all these other things with that are settled there to come up to Solana with better than honest majority guarantees. I think all that stuff is really cool. That doesn't mean that like it ends up as a great business or not, right? Like
maybe that should have been the question. Ethereum is a business model. It should have been a spicier take. Yeah.
I think the thing like in a lot of these Ethereum talking heads like don't realize Ethereum's the first project I got it. Like I still like Ethereum. Maddie was been involved in Ethereum ecosystem forever. Like it's like most Solana people love and respect Ethereum. We just get torched online every day. So people were just very reactive about it.
Steel sharpens steel. I think all of these debates have made everyone better.
Yeah, agreed. Well, cool, Tolly. Thanks for we're hitting right on the hour, man. Thanks for joining for the kickoff of Coliseum Podcast and Maddie co-hosting this time. We will see you next time to discuss more wounded animals.
That's right.
The Wounded Animal Podcast. That's the name.
We're going to rebrand immediately. Tolly, thanks so much for coming on. It's also just great to catch up with both of you. We go way back.
We all work for different companies. We all used to work for the same company.
Yeah, we used to work together 2020, 2021. So, yeah. Thanks, man.
Cool.
Really appreciate it.
All right. Bye, guys.
See you guys.
Bye.